KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump says he is not joking about the possibility of running for a third term. That's not possible under the Constitution, and the president won't say what he's planning. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. RFK Jr. is cutting Health and Human Services staff and closing offices around the country. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. We speak to a former HHS secretary who tells us why she turned down a dramatic reorganization plan during her tenure. Also, Wisconsin's Supreme Court race is the most expensive judicial election ever, and a new National Medal of Honor Museum in Texas tells the stories of war heroes. It's Monday, March 31st, which is the day back in 1918 that we started losing that hour of sleep, the start of daylight saving time. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump says he's not joking when it comes to talking about potentially serving a third term in the White House. The 22nd Amendment to the U.S. Constitution says that no one can be elected more than twice to the office of the presidency. But Trump told reporters yesterday on Air Force One that his supporters would like him to stay in office.
What I'm talking about, I'm just telling you, I have had more people say, please run again. They said, we have a long way to go before we even think about that.
Trump declined to answer when he was asked if he is planning to leave office at the end of his term in January 2029. This week, President Trump's 25% tariffs on all imported automobiles and parts are set to go into effect. Trump says he will also announce a new wave of tariffs. NPR's Amy Held reports this comes as consumers grow more worried about the U.S. economy.
Aman Singh manages a Toyota dealership in New York. He says people keep calling, concerned about pricier cars.
We've been telling them, hey, listen, if you pick something I have here, it's that price.
For now, car prices would be likely to go up, analysts say, as companies pass tariff costs onto consumers.
The tariff issue is worrisome.
Jim Diley runs Fulton Brewing in Minneapolis. For him, it's tariffs on Canadian barley and aluminum.
It does mean dollars and cents for someone running a brewery.
Consumers also keeping a closer eye on their own dollars and cents, as surveys show consumer confidence is slipping. The Trump administration says tariffs will raise billions for the government and boost domestic production. Amy Held, NPR News.
The military authorities in the South Asian country of Myanmar say the death toll has risen to more than 1,700 people after last Friday's major earthquake. Thousands more people are wounded. Michael Sullivan reports from neighboring Thailand that some foreign assistance has now started arriving.
Rescue efforts have been stymied by a lack of equipment and personnel, especially in the hardest hit areas in and around Myanmar's second city, Mandalay. There, some are digging with their hands, even as the chance of finding survivors grows more remote every hour. Emergency response teams from China, India, and Russia have arrived in country, as well as teams from Singapore and Malaysia. A Chinese search and rescue team has now reached Mandalay after traveling by road from the border. The airport in Mandalay is still closed to large aircraft, so much of the foreign assistance is being flown to Yangon, some 350 miles to the south. For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Chiang Rai, Thailand.
A court in France has convicted the leader of France's far-right party, the National Rally, of embezzling money from European Union funds. The court has sentenced Marine Le Pen to 4 years in prison, with two of those years suspended. Le Pen cannot now run for public office for 5 years. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. In the U.S., a federal appeals court panel will allow President Trump to remove Democratic members from two federal labor boards. The appeals court decision came last Friday, but now the labor panels don't have enough members to decide cases. The work of those agencies will stall. Federal authorities are investigating a suspicious fire in New Mexico. It broke out early yesterday at the headquarters of the state Republican Party. From member station KUNM, Megan Kamrick reports GOP representatives in New Mexico say authorities found graffiti about the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency there.
Firefighters quickly put out the blaze and no injuries were reported. The FBI and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives are investigating. An ATF official says they found incendiary materials but did not provide details. A GOP-provided photo shows graffiti on the building saying ICE equals KKK. State Republican Party Chair Amy Barella said the fire was fueled by hatred and intolerance. Albuquerque's Mayor Democrat Tim Keller said politically motivated crimes of any kind are unacceptable. The fire comes a week after a former Republican statehouse candidate was convicted in a series of shootings at the homes of Democratic lawmakers. For NPR News, I'm Megan Kamarick in Albuquerque.
Forecasters say severe thunderstorms are rolling through the south this morning. A flash flood warning is posted just north of New Orleans. Parts of Alabama and Mississippi are getting drenched. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The Department of Health and Human Services is set to lose about a quarter of its workforce under an overhaul planned by the Trump administration. We speak with a former head of the agency about what this could mean.
First, could President Trump get elected to a third term in office? The Constitution says no.
But President Trump has declined to rule out the possibility of serving a third term. Yesterday, Trump told NBC News' Kristen Welker in a phone call that he is, quote, not joking about staying on as president, and said there are ways he could, although he did not elaborate.
Joining us to talk about all this is NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith, who was traveling with the president this weekend. Good morning, Tam.
Good morning.
So Trump has talked about serving a third term many times. I think people assumed he was joking, and based on the plain language of the 22nd Amendment, that would not be constitutional. So what's going on here?
You know, the way he talks about a third term, it's like he's keeping his options open. On Air Force One, I asked him about what he told NBC and asked if that means he's not planning to leave office. And here's what he said.
I'm not looking at that, but I'll tell you, I have had more people ask me to have a third term.
Later, I asked him again to clarify, are you planning to leave office on January 20th, 2029, or are you saying you might not? And he looked to the other reporters and said, any other questions? He also said it is still quite early to be having these conversations. And as you say, the 22nd Amendment bars a president from being elected to a third term. But there are some novel legal theories that have been floated. And while they are quite far-fetched, the fact that Trump isn't dismissing it out of hand means it can't be ignored.
Is there support for a third Trump term, as he says?
Trump's approval rating is underwater right now, but these are better poll numbers than he's seen before, and there is something of a movement among his most ardent supporters to promote the idea of a third term. Earlier this month, Steve Bannon, who served in Trump's first White House and is now an influential podcaster, said that he not only thinks Trump should run, but that he'd win. Separately, just 3 days into Trump's second term, a Republican congressman introduced a constitutional amendment to pave the way for a third Trump term. But just to go back to the Constitution, there are actually two amendments that would stand in his way. The 22nd Amendment is one of those. It was put in place after FDR served four terms. Separately, the 12th Amendment prevents anyone disqualified constitutionally from being the president from being the vice president.
Is there a political reason for Trump to be saying this?
Yeah, you know, he's in his second and final term, unless something dramatic happens. And that means the clock is ticking on his power and relevance, because soon members of his own party will be running to replace him, and he will be seen as a lame duck. So teasing a third term has the potential, at least, to extend his influence.
Before we let you go, in his conversation with NBC's Kristen Welker, Trump also made news on tariffs. Tell us what he said there, please.
Yeah, he stood firm on the 25% tariffs on foreign automobile imports, including parts made outside of the U.S. He dismissed concerns that this could cause prices to rise for American consumers. He said, quote, "I couldn't care less, because if the prices on foreign cars go up, they're going to buy American cars." But even cars assembled in the U.S. often contain parts made in other countries. The president is promising additional tariffs later this week. He is calling Wednesday Liberation Day. Economists warn higher tariffs mean increased costs for consumers, and polls show that voters just want the president to focus on bringing costs down.
That is NPR's Tamara Keith. Tam, thank you.
You're welcome.
Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. plans to dramatically transform the Department of Health and Human Services. He is aiming to lay off some 10,000 workers, eliminate departments, and close regional offices. Another 10,000 employees have already left their jobs. So if this plan goes forward, it would represent a cut of about a quarter of the agency's staff. To understand what these changes could mean, we've called Donna Shalala. She headed HHS under President Bill Clinton from 1993 to 2001, and she is with us now. Good morning, Madam Secretary. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
I want to begin with a video that Secretary Kennedy shared on Elon Musk's social media platform X about his plans. Here it is.
We're going to eliminate an entire alphabet soup of departments and agencies while preserving their core functions by merging them into a new organization called the Administration for a Healthy America, or AHA.
I understand that you were approached with a proposal to reorganize the department when you headed the agency. Now, it was not the same as this plan, but in a recent op-ed, you wrote about why you rejected it. Could you just briefly tell us why?
Well, because it slows down your ability to get improvements in the department. I'm not into structural reform, and it just takes up so much time. It unsettles the people that you need to work, and they've combined this structure, which doesn't make a lot of sense, with firing people. You can't fire the lead people for infectious diseases while you've got a measles outbreak. You can't fire 1,000 people if the FDA, when you want to protect new vaccines, medical devices. It just makes no sense what they're doing. And they don't understand the department and its programs well enough to do these kinds of changes. So cutting a quarter of the workforce, it makes no sense. And it's probably dangerous for the future.
Well, let me dig into that in a minute. But one of the things you said in your op-ed is that you advised this colleague who presented this plan, unless it was data and outcome driven, that it was a waste of time. Do you think that this reorganization plan as presented by the current secretary is data and outcome driven?
There's no evidence that it is.
So, and you say this would be dangerous. Can you say more about that? Why?
Well, because willy-nilly firing people and trying to do reorganization and slowing down the decision-making in the department, its ability to manage something like the measles outbreak and other outbreaks that are to come, slowing down the progress that FDA will make on the approval of drugs, slowing down and eliminating what drives our economy, and that is the scientific research and our deep investments in the NIH, is going backwards, not forwards.
The secretary argues that the agency's core functions will still be performed, but this just eliminates bureaucratic overlay. Could that be true?
No.
And
there's not a chance. What he calls bureaucratic overlay is actually the leadership of different programs.
So the top vaccine official of the Food and Drug Administration, Peter Marks, has resigned. He cited Secretary Kennedy's, quote, misinformation and lies as the reason for his departure. Now, people resign for policy differences before in other administrations. Is there something about this that you find noteworthy?
Yes, it's fundamental. And he's basically saying the opposite of what people in Congress on the Republican side are saying. He said, he's basically saying Robert Kennedy Jr., the secretary, is not committed to vaccines, particularly vaccines for children.
But, and how is that different from, I'm thinking during the Clinton administration, I'm thinking about Peter Edelman, who resigned over the administration's direction on welfare policy. Is there something different than that? People resign when they disagree with the direction of the administration. Is there something fundamentally different about this?
Absolutely, because when Peter resigned, this was not about people dying. It was about a difference in how you would administer the welfare program for this country. It turned out to be pretty successful during that time. But in this case, it's about science. It's about whether you believe in childhood vaccines or you don't believe in childhood vaccines, and whether children are going to get ill because you're sending mixed messages to parents all over the country. The anti-vax movement has resulted in children that should not be getting sick, getting sick.
You know, I'm going to ask you to put on your member of Congress hat now, because you've had a long and varied career. I mentioned that you're a secretary of an agency, you're an assistant secretary at HUD, you've also been a university president, and you know, you've taught in public health, so you've had a long and varied career, but you're also a member of Congress. One of the arguments that people are making here is that the Democrats have not done a good job of explaining why these cuts matter to the American people. Do you think that that might be true?
I don't think it's completely true, because I see it at the local level. Once you get out of Washington, you see members of Congress explaining to their communities what the impact of these cuts are. And by the way, if you live in New Mexico or in Texas and you see the measles outbreak, if you're getting Social Security and you find out that you can't go to your local office because they're closing it, you see the impacts. So over the next few months, Americans are going to see the impacts of what I believe are irresponsible cuts in government programs and in our ability to deliver successfully to help people stay healthy and to improve their welfare.
So what should your fellow people who are concerned as you are should be doing right now, particularly people in leadership? What should they be doing?
They should be talking to their members of Congress and their senators. They should be talking to them about how they feel these cuts are irresponsible, that they're dangerous to our health. And by the way, the business community needs to step up. If I was Big Pharma, if I represented the pharmaceutical companies, I'd be concerned with Peter Marks leaving and 1,000 people being cut from the FDA. What does that say about investors who have fueled our economy with these deep investments in bioscience and in our pharmaceutical industry?
We have to leave it there. That is Donna Shalala, former Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services under President Bill Clinton. Madam Secretary, thank you for joining us. And I do want to say here that NPR has invited Robert F. Kennedy Jr. for an interview several times since his confirmation as HHS Secretary. His office has declined our request so far, but our invitation still stands. This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, British actor Stephen Graham, who's starring in two new shows. In the Hulu series A Thousand Blows, he plays a real-life bare-knuckle boxer fighting in Victorian London. And in Netflix's Adolescence, he plays the father of a 13-year-old boy arrested for murdering a classmate. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance, working to help protect small businesses and the owners that run them, offering customizable coverages to salons, accounting firms, tradespeople, and more. Learn more at progressivecommercial.com. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. From Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19. The CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The Supreme Court hears a case today about whether charities run by religious groups have to pay unemployment taxes that cover their employees. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
Ironically, today's case comes from Wisconsin, which in 1932, at the height of the Depression, became the first state in the nation to set up an unemployment compensation program. The experiment failed, largely because paying into the fund was optional and employers dropped out, often to undercut their competitors. But 3 years later, Congress enacted a federal state unemployment system that required all employers, including nonprofits, to pay into the system so that employees who lose their jobs can pay their basic bills. The only exemptions were for religious employers who conduct programs that are, quote, operated primarily for religious purposes. Today's case was brought by a single chapter of Catholic Charities affiliated with the Diocese of Superior in northern Wisconsin. The chapter contends that it's entitled to be exempted from the state's mandatory unemployment compensation system because it's a charitable organization that carries out a religious mission. At the same time, however, Catholic Charities specifically eschews indoctrination. There's no proselytizing permitted, and employees include Catholics and non-Catholics alike.
I don't think it detracts from the fact that this is part of a religious mission.
Eric Rosbach represents Catholic Charities.
The Catholic Church tells people you're supposed to help other people.
But is that enough to qualify for an exemption from a compulsory state compensation system? The state of Wisconsin says it is not, noting that other nonprofits, and indeed even other Catholic Charities chapters, do not seek religious exemptions, even though they, too, are run by the diocese they serve. The state declined to provide anyone for an interview about today's case, but in its brief it contends that the work that Catholic Charities does is, quote, typical of the work done by other nonprofits, and that without a religious gloss on the actual services that are provided by the charity, it's just like any other nonprofit that must pay into the state system. Rosbach, however, counters that forcing Catholic Charities to participate interferes with the church's free exercise of religion, and that it unconstitutionally entangles church and state. He sees the mandatory system as perverse because under the state's rationale, Catholic Charities could opt out of the system if it proselytized or employed only Catholics, but it cannot opt out when it acts as the charitable arm of a diocese. So why does this branch of Catholic Charities want to opt out of the state program? It wants to join something called the Church Unemployment Pay Program, known as CUP, which provides unemployment compensation for employees at churches, Catholic schools, and other overtly religious church affiliates. Again, lawyer Rosbach.
We think this will definitely save us some money. You know, it will save them money that they can then use to carry out the rest of their mission.
Our concern is that you get what you pay for.
Lawrence Dupuy filed a brief in the case on behalf of the Economic Policy Institute, siding with the state of Wisconsin.
In fact, the CUP program disclaims any responsibility if the employer doesn't have sufficient reserves set aside. And you'd lose all the federal add-ons that go along with this and that are especially important during deep downturns.
As a practical matter, Dupuis says he doesn't see CUP as equivalent to the state unemployment compensation program. And he warns that if the Supreme Court allows Catholic Charities of Superior to opt out, there will be no stopping point for other organizations.
Catholic hospitals alone employ 500,000 people, and we estimate 1.2 million people employed by religiously affiliated nonprofits.
If all of these Catholic hospitals and religious employers were to opt out of the state insurance systems, he says it would put a genuine strain on the system's viability, a strain that could be felt in 46 other states that have religious exemption laws similar to Wisconsin's. Notwithstanding all that, the state of Wisconsin is likely playing a weak hand at the Supreme Court. Catholic Charities is a revered organization that does everything from providing aid to the needy to aiding the resettlement of refugees. The Supreme Court's conservative supermajority has repeatedly sided with the church's position in religion cases, and 7 of the 9 justices were raised Catholic. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
The doors are now open at the new National Medal of Honor Museum in Arlington, Texas.
The Medal of Honor is the highest military decoration in the U.S. for valor on the battlefield. The museum's mission, according to CEO and President Chris Cassidy, is to inspire.
We're going to do that through the stories of Medal of Honor recipients and the values that the medal has, such as courage, sacrifice, commitment, service over self, service to others, and patriotism, citizenship. All those kind of things are embedded in the DNA of the medal.
Cassidy is also a veteran.
I was in the Navy for 28 years, 11 of those in the SEAL teams, and 17 as a NASA astronaut down at the Johnson Space Center in Houston, and flew in space 3 different times.
The National Medal of Honor was first awarded in the Civil War, and since then, about 3,500 service members have earned it. Only 61 are alive today.
The museum is backed by high-profile donors like Dallas Cowboys owner Jerry Jones. The names of medal recipients are engraved around a rotunda called the Ring of Valor, and photos of the recipients cover the museum's walls.
Among them is Captain William Swenson, who was serving in Afghanistan in 2009 when his unit was ambushed. Swenson risked his life to carry the wounded to safety.
Obviously, I was called to serve at a very high level. Sometimes that's what happens in military service, and that was a reaction in 2009, and the award was 2013.
The firefight claimed the lives of 5 Americans and 10 Afghan Army troops.
The museum's opening, Swenson says, was an incredible experience for him.
One of the things that comes with this award is the understanding that you don't wear it for yourself, you wear it for others. You wear it for your teammates who were there at the battle, but you ultimately wear it for the service members who, if they were called upon to do the same thing I did, they would as well.
Ultimately, he says, the museum represents American values.
When you go inside, when you see this physical structure and you look at these stories and you think to yourself, this is history, it's not so much history as it is vignettes of what everyday Americans did on behalf of their comrades.
Even though Swenson says the museum can't fully capture the service and sacrifice, it is a place where their stories can be told. This is NPR News.
A Biden-era program allowing more than 200,000 Ukrainians to come to the U.S. was halted by President Trump. Now, thousands of Ukrainians in the U.S. face an uncertain future.
Ukrainians, we cannot create any plans for our lives because of this situation. Like, we cannot live full life.
Planning for a future on pause. On All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump's 25% tariffs on U.S. imports of cars and auto parts take effect this week. Jörg Kukies is Germany's finance minister.
We should negotiate before talking about retaliation, but of course everyone knows that if a negotiation doesn't work, then retaliation is of course always a possibility.
He was speaking to NPR's Morning Edition. Economists warn the tariffs will add thousands of dollars to the cost of many vehicles sold in the U.S. International aid groups say people in Myanmar are in desperate need of help following Friday's powerful earthquake. The death toll tops 1,700. Bodies are still being pulled from the rubble of toppled homes and other buildings. A Muslim organization says hundreds of people were killed when the quake damaged or leveled dozens of mosques. People had gathered there for Friday prayers during Ramadan when the quake hit. Michael Dunford is the director of the World Food Program. He says conditions in Myanmar were already poor before the magnitude 7.7 earthquake.
This isn't a country that already was experiencing a humanitarian catastrophe because of an ongoing civil conflict, a civil war that has been raging now for 4 years.
He was speaking outside a hospital in the country's capital. The quake also shook neighboring Thailand. This is NPR News. A judge in Paris is barring far-right French leader Marine Le Pen from seeking public office for 5 years. As NPR's Rebecca Rossman reports, Le Pen was convicted of embezzling funds from the European Union.
Le Pen has long been a dominant figure in French politics as longtime leader of the nationalist anti-immigration National Rally Party. But this conviction stems from accusations that she misused millions of dollars in EU funds to pay party staff while serving as a member of the European Parliament. She denies wrongdoing and plans to appeal, but the ruling remains in effect, likely barring her from the 2027 presidential race. Rebecca Rossman, NPR News, Paris.
Despite the constitutional limits, President Trump did not dismiss the idea of pursuing a third term in the White House in an interview yesterday with NBC News. SpaceX is hoping to make history today. The company is preparing to launch 4 passengers on the first human spaceflight to orbit the Earth's poles. If all goes as planned at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, a Falcon 9 rocket will carry the 4 into orbit aboard a Dragon space capsule. None of the 4 astronauts has traveled in space. They include a cryptocurrency billionaire. Stocks opened lower on Wall Street moments ago. The Dow is down more than 300 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. An election in Wisconsin tomorrow is the most expensive judicial race in American history. As Wisconsin Public Radio's Anya Van Wagtendonk reports, the contest is being fueled by out-of-state billionaires.
By the time I finish reading this sentence, the total tally has probably changed, so I'll just say a lot of money is funneling into Wisconsin, like close to $100 million a lot. Donors are backing either Dane County Judge Susan Crawford.
I'm Susan Crawford, and looking out for people is why I became a prosecutor and a judge.
Or Waukesha County Judge Brad Schimmel.
I'm Brad Schimmel, and justice is my life's work.
She's liberal, he's conservative. Whoever wins will determine the ideological majority on the nonpartisan Wisconsin Supreme Court, with issues like abortion, voting, and labor law at stake. They're both getting plenty of small donations, but in Wisconsin, state parties can receive unlimited donations and spend that money with no caps. And in this race, a handful of out-of-state billionaires are really taking advantage of that.
Thanks for coming. What do you think of my hat?
Top of that list is Elon Musk. That's him last night at a rally in Green Bay, Wisconsin, wearing a Packers cheese head. And he spelled out what he says are the stakes when it comes to electing Schimmel.
I feel like this is one of those things that may not seem that it's going to affect the entire destiny of humanity, but I think it will.
Musk personally gave millions to the Wisconsin Republican Party, and two of his spending groups have given at least $17 million supporting Schimmel. They've produced ads arguing Schimmel will support President Donald Trump's agenda. Susan Crawford, again his opponent, has argued that means Schimmel is bought and sold by Musk.
He has basically taken over Brad Schimmel's campaign.
As for her campaign, a big spender is the liberal megadonor George Soros. He's given $2 million to the Wisconsin Democratic Party. So, of course, Schimmel has fired back that Soros, a boogeyman of the right, is controlling Crawford.
He's a dangerous person to have an endorsement from.
Crawford also has support from Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker. He's a hotel's heir who self-financed his own campaigns. He's also given Wisconsin Democrats $1.5 million to support Crawford. Pritzker has supported Wisconsin politics before, like when he rallied Democrats at the state party convention in Milwaukee ahead of last year's presidential race.
We will be Midwest nice to you while we Midwest beat you.
Two other Illinois billionaires are looking north to Wisconsin. That's Richard and Elizabeth Uline. If you've ever seen a Uline cardboard box or truck, that's their company. All told, they've spent about $8 million supporting Schimmel.
Besides being shocked at spending that much money on a Wisconsin Supreme Court race, I'm also very distressed.
That's the way former Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Jeanine Geske describes watching the fundraising hit the stratosphere. She sat on the bench in the mid-90s and...
My race so long ago was totally $250,000.
And she says she's worried about what all this money means for judicial fairness.
I think what's happening is just a nightmare and really going to the heart of our independence as that third branch of government.
Geske and other retired judges once asked the court to change its rules to require recusal in cases involving campaign donors. The court's then conservative majority declined. They said it would chill free speech. So, donors could easily see their interests go before the court. That means Crawford and Schimmel have a line to walk, each arguing that the other is beholden to special interests while accepting big checks of their own. For NPR News, I'm Anya Van Wagtendonk.
President Trump has issued an executive order to try to make changes at the Smithsonian Institution.
The Smithsonian is the world's largest museum, education, and research complex, and it's comprised of 21 museums and libraries each, 14 education centers, and the National Zoo. The order also paves the way for the return of monuments that have been removed in recent years.
NPR culture reporter Isabella Gomez Sarmiento is with us now for more. Good morning, Isabella.
Good morning.
So the order is called Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History. Maybe start by telling us a bit more about what it says.
A lot of this is about the people and stories that are highlighted at these museums and sites and the language used to describe American history. The order directs Vice President J.D. Vance, who is on the Smithsonian's Board of Regents, to oversee the removal of, quote, improper, divisive, or anti-American ideology from the Smithsonian's museums and research centers. Smithsonian Secretary Lonnie Bunch sent an email on Friday telling staff that the Smithsonian will continue to employ internal review processes and that, quote, as always, our work will be shaped by the best scholarship, free of partisanship, to help the American public better understand the nation's history, challenges, and triumphs. The Smithsonian spokesperson confirmed that email to NPR, and we should note here Lonnie Bunch was previously the founding director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture, one of the museums Trump singled out in the executive order.
There's also a section of the executive order focused on monuments. What does that say?
That's right. I mean, if we can rewind a little bit, there's been a growing movement in recent years to reflect on what history we honor in the U.S. and what may have been left out. But there was a turning point when a white police officer killed George Floyd, who was black, in 2020. His death sparked wide protests, and for a lot of people, it was a reexamining of this country's racial history. Within a year and a half, 200 public Confederate symbols had been taken down, relocated, or renamed. That included things like monuments, school names, even road names. Those are numbers provided by the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is a legal and advocacy group, which tracks Confederate iconography in the U.S. I should say, the executive order isn't specifically about Confederate symbols, but it instructs the Interior Secretary to review monuments, markers, and statues that may have been taken down or changed since January 2020, more than a year before Trump left office in his first term, and restore them. It calls for a wholesale review to make sure that memorials under Interior Department jurisdiction, quote, do not contain descriptions, depictions, or other content that inappropriately disparage Americans past or living, including persons living in colonial times.
Do we know what monuments could actually be put back up?
That's the big question, and it's pretty unclear right now. Seth Levy of the Southern Poverty Law Center says many of the sites that did see changes were on land controlled by municipalities and state governments, not land controlled by the Department of the Interior or any of the bureaus it oversees, like the National Park Service.
I'm not actually aware of any removals on National Park Service land.
We reached out to the Department of the Interior and didn't hear back.
So, you know, a lot of this executive order focuses on how the story of America is told. So what are historians saying about this?
That's right. I spoke with art historian Erin Thompson. She's the author of a book called Smashing Statues, The Rise and Fall of America's Public Monuments. And she says that Trump's executive order is trying to gloss over some of the darker aspects of American history.
That you can't turn an ugly history into a glorious one unless you're not telling the truth.
Thompson says it's important to grapple with mistakes from the past so we don't make them again. But ultimately, you can't control historical memory by controlling monuments.
That's NPR culture reporter Isabella Gomez Sarmiento. Isabella, thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd's new book is a collection of interviews with the notorious Paul Newman, Tina Fey, Elon Musk. Next time, here and now.
Your city, your station, your news. Download the NPR app today, your new home for live radio, local podcasts, and everything you love from NPR.
Good morning, me Martinez. Black rhinos are endangered. In South Africa, they get moved around to protect against poaching, but since they're 3,000 pounds, the safest way is by helicopter and upside down. Tranquilizers lower their oxygen levels, but upside down, their spines straighten out, which helps them breathe. And their horns act like a bird's tail feather, keeping them steady, even aerodynamic. When they wake up, I wonder if they wonder, how did I get here? It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Maybe you're still smarting over your March Madness fails or celebrating your wins, and maybe you put some money on it. If you did, you wouldn't be alone. Americans were expected to bet $3 billion on the tournament this year alone. But when does sports betting become a problem? NPR's Katia Riddle has this report.
To be clear, most people who gamble enjoy it responsibly, but not everyone. This man's name is Scott. He's a lifelong sports fan and a high school coach. He says people like him have a hard time disentangling gambling from their passion for sports.
Because it's something that we love.
March Madness, he says, is extra difficult.
Everyone I know that gambles just goes crazy this time of year, from the conference tournaments through the national championship game.
Scott asked that NPR just use his first name for this story. He's been in recovery for a few months. He says he's not ready to face the stigma around problem gambling that he would encounter if he talked about it publicly.
It feels like a character defect. It feels like I'd be admitting to being stupid.
A lot more people are legally gambling in recent years. Sports betting is now legal in roughly two-thirds of the country. Some online gambling platforms also have casino games like blackjack and roulette. Michelle Malkin is the director of the Gambling Research and Policy Initiative at East Carolina University. She says unlike drugs and alcohol, many people don't know the signs of gambling addiction.
It usually starts with like somebody's really preoccupied with gambling. They want to go gamble by themselves, whether at home or if they do gambling like at a casino, but they don't tend to do it as a social activity anymore.
These behaviors can trigger the same neural pathways as substance use disorders.
Like they might try to stop, but they just can't seem to stay stopped for very long.
Gambling disorders can lead to tragedy, failed relationships and careers, even suicide. Malkin calls it the gambler's fallacy.
That to fix these problems that have been caused by gambling, I just need to gamble more. And it becomes cyclical because then they are digging the hole deeper and deeper.
There are some outpatient therapists who specialize in gambling addiction. There are also a small number of programs around the country that do inpatient treatment. Many people say the first step, find a support group. Here's Scott.
You have to find connections. You have to find human connections.
Gamblers Anonymous is an organization like Alcoholics Anonymous, but not every place in the U.S. has a meeting. Scott says he had to look to online message boards, places like Reddit, to find people struggling with the same problem.
Even if it's one person at the beginning.
Jeffrey Wasserman runs an online support group for people struggling with gambling. He says quitting sports betting is especially difficult.
So now you're asking me to give up the two things in life that I love the most, and that is gambling and sports.
He compares it to an eating disorder. Just like learning to be around food, people can learn to be around sports. He says start small. For example, try a week-long break or record a game so you're not tempted to bet on the results.
Like anything else, you can approach it in a measured way.
A measured way to get back to a love of the game without the risk of losing everything. Katie Riddle, NPR News.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Amy Martinez. Today is the 30-year anniversary of the liberation of Bucha, a suburb north of Kyiv. It was under Russian occupation for a month right after the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February of 2022. Ukraine has asked for the destruction there to be investigated as a crime against humanity. Russia denies it committed war crimes. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley is in Bucha. Eleanor, remind us what happened there.
Yeah, well, the Russian army arrived here just a few days after the invasion. They were coming from the north, but they got bogged down and ended up staying in Bucha for 33 days. Their headquarters was a school here. And when they were finally pushed out, the world discovered the carnage through physical evidence and the stories of those who'd survived. More than 400 civilians were killed. People were shot at point-blank range in the street and left to rot. Old men were shot off their bicycles. People were held in basements for weeks. Many were tortured. And a mass grave was found on the church grounds. You might remember some of the pictures of that one street that was completely destroyed with the burned-out Russian tanks and also the dead bodies just lying in the streets for weeks. It completely shocked Ukrainians and the world, frankly, and it became a kind of moral turning point for this war. Of course, as you said, Russia has always denied it. They say fake videos were created of the whole thing.
So what's it like today, and how are they marking this liberation?
Well, we've driven up here. It's about 25 miles northwest of Kyiv. It's a very nice suburb, well off, you know, surrounded by pine forests, and everything that was destroyed has been rebuilt. And while there are no real signs of physically what happened, the mental wounds are still deep. There's a wall of names of those killed on the church ground, and they're planning a much bigger memorial project. It will be kind of a memory space to tell the story of the 33 days of occupation, not through numbers and dates, but through an interactive experience where visitors will go down into a tunnel and then emerge again into the light. And today, President Zelensky is supposed to participate in a ceremony this afternoon with some of the soldiers who helped liberate this town.
Eleanor, what are the residents of Bucha telling you?
Well, I spoke with 43-year-old Dmytro, who actually came here 3 years ago from Mariupol, the Ukrainian city on the Black Sea that was besieged and destroyed by Russia in the first weeks of the war. He preferred not to give his last name because he may be conscripted into the army. He told me he wished President Trump would come here himself with his staff to see what happened and to see how we live, he said.
It's Ukraine. It's not Russia. It's not part of some Russian colony. We are a different nation, we are different people, we have different goals, we have different values.
And you know, I asked him, what are those values? And he had one word.
Freedom is the most, freedom.
So, you know, many Ukrainians told me 3 years on, as war fatigue sets in, the world really needs to be reminded of what happened here and to remember that Ukraine is not just fighting for its territory, it's fighting for its identity, its very existence, and fighting to prevent atrocities like what happened in Bucha.
That's NPR's Eleanor Beardsley in Bucha, Ukraine. Eleanor, thanks.
You're welcome, A.
Nonviolent protests against Tesla and its CEO Elon Musk continued over the weekend. The Tesla takedown movement is urging people to sell their Tesla cars in stock. Protesters are upset with Musk and his role heading Doge, the Department of Government Efficiency, which has led aggressive cuts across the federal government. Tesla sales are down in Europe and in China, and many analysts say the brand is in trouble.
It's not just the political thing. That's just the icing on the cake. It's his lack of focus and interest in a car company, which has been demonstrated by lack of innovation, and his attention going everywhere but the car company.
That's Alan Adamson. He's worked as a brand and marketing consultant for more than 30 years.
Whenever a business fails, it's never about one thing. It's usually about many things. So the brand's problems now are yes, his Doge issue, his Cybertruck recall, lots of things. But it's never just one thing. It's having a cumulative effect, and it's reached the tipping point.
Now, have there been other examples that you could point to in the past where something that a CEO has said or done affected their company sales?
Not in the car industry, for sure. You know, there are smaller examples, but nothing at this scale.
Alan, what is it, though, about cars that make it such a different market than other products? I mean, is it one of those things where when you buy a car, it says something about you without saying anything at all necessarily?
Yeah, most people think, you know, they buy the car, they give a rationale. I bought the car because it has good acceleration. I like the way it steers. But when you look at car performance, there's no difference between cars. They all get roughly the same mileage, either electric or gas.
They all roll, right? They all roll on the road.
Right. You look inside, they all hook up to your smartphone. In fact, when you get in many cars, and if you don't look at the brand, you have no idea what car you're in. And so cars are what we call badge brands. They are identity signals. They say, I'm driving a BMW. I'm driving a Ford pickup truck, because it says something about you. It's more like a beer brand and a fashion brand. You park it in a driveway to say, look at me, I'm a green person, I'm driving a Tesla, or look at me, I'm a real macho person, I'm driving this big pickup truck. And so cars are always about the brand image. And once the brand image is not something you want to say to your neighbors, you're in big trouble in a category that's brand driven.
But would it be easy if, say, for some reason, somehow he divests in Tesla, sells every bit of stock and ownership stake that he has in Tesla, and then all of a sudden has nothing to do with the brand?
That would be probably the best thing for the brand. That's the only easy fix, which is I'm selling it. I'm going to focus, you know, other things I'm interested in. And the new ownership team is going to keep their eye on the ball, because I think the issue is focus. If you're building a car that has your life at stake when you drive it, you don't want a brand perception that people at the company are moving fast and breaking things. You want somebody you can trust to say, when I get in this car, the wheels aren't going to fall off, or I'm not going to get killed. So having this sort of erratic personality is probably a more damaging brand attribute than helping the government try to save money on federal employees.
So I think the lesson, Alan, here is for any current CEO or aspiring CEO is maybe don't ever talk politics publicly.
That's always been a lesson. And now the more polarized the country is, the more true it is. And it will be a good lesson for other CEOs to say, look, as much as my employees want me to speak out or I want to speak out, less is more.
That's Alan Adamson. He's the CEO and co-founder of the brand and marketing consultancy Metaforce. Alan, thanks a lot.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Musk told Fox News last week, quote, Tesla is a peaceful company that has made great cars and said it hasn't harmed anyone. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.